Sunday evenings, then, we're just going through some Psalms. We're in the 60s of the Book of Psalms, and the one then that we're looking at this evening is the one that I read earlier on, Psalm 65. And as we grapple for a while this evening with this psalm, there are three words around which I want us to structure our exposition. And the first word then is phases, P-H-A-S-E-S, phases. In the middle of verse 5, we have that delightful title, God of our salvation, ever since that day in Eden when disaster occurred and everything went wrong. This has been God's great project. Into this, he has been pouring his wisdom and his power and his grace, our salvation. It seems almost too good to be true, that, doesn't it? But this is the wonderful news which the Bible tells, that since man's rebellion, God hasn't been busily immersed in a program of destruction and damnation, but rather in a program of salvation. And as you would expect then of a brilliant and resourceful God, this salvation of his is not a flimsy little affair. It's grand and elaborate. It takes shape bit by bit, gathering momentum as history unfolds. And as it does that then, as God's salvation progressively takes shape, different phases of it emerge. And that's relevant then to this psalm here. The psalm is in three sections. You can see that from the way that it's laid out in the ESV. So there's verses 1 to 4, that's one section. Then verses 5 to 8, that's a second section. And then verses 9 to 13, that's a third section. And each of those sections relates to a different phase of salvation. So do you get that? I'm saying that Psalm 65 takes us on this rapid, breathless journey through God's salvation program and divides it into three phases. Now, the three phases into which the psalm divides salvation, in a theological textbook, they would be described something like this. Phase number one is the era of salvation up until the day of Pentecost. Phase number two is the era of salvation which follows and is ushered in by the day of Pentecost. And phase number three is then the great finale, the culmination of salvation at the very end. And those then are the three phases that we have in this psalm. And you may find it helpful then having them set out in those terms before we go any further. So I'll just say it again. Phase number one is the era up until the day of Pentecost. Phase number two is the era of salvation that follows and is ushered in by the day of Pentecost. And phase number three is the great finale, the culmination of salvation at the very end. However, because our passage this evening is not a theological textbook, it's an Old Testament psalm, those three phases aren't presented quite as Louis Burkhoff or Wayne Grudem might present them. They're presented actually from a couple of different angles. So on the one hand, the psalm links the three phases with three successive arenas, if you like, where God is particularly at work. In phase number one, in verses 1 to 4, the arena where God is particularly at work is the temple. You can see there are numerous references to it in those verses. Zion, your courts, your house, your temple. But then as phase number one passes and in verses 5 to 8, phase number two takes its place, the arena where God is particularly at work is the nations. Verse 5 refers to the ends of the earth. Verse 7 to the peoples. And verse 8 to those who dwell literally at the edges. But then, as phase number two also passes and gives way in verses 9 to 13 to phase number three, the arena where God is particularly at work becomes the creation. Notice the piling up of different creation landscapes in verses 12 and 13. The wilderness, the hills, the meadows, the valleys. So as I say, that's one angle from which the three phases are presented here. As his salvation progresses throughout history, God, as it were, moves between these different arenas. He focuses first on the temple, then on the nations, and then finally on the creation. But complementing that angle, the psalm presents the three phases from another angle too. It links them with three successive problems which God in his salvation overcomes. And this is where we really touch on the pulse beat of the psalm. So, in phase one then, in verses 1 to 4, the problem which God overcomes is sin. It's sin. We don't have that actual word in those verses, but we have others like it. Verse 3 refers to iniquities and to transgressions. Verse 3 also features a rather chilling verb. Sin, verse 3 says, prevails against us. It triumphs over us. It gets the better of us. The point is that sin makes us guilty and liable to hell. And we can try with all our might, as many do, to fight back. We can fight back by being ever so morally upstanding. We can fight back by being ever so religiously zealous, but none of it works. Sin always prevails. No one gets to the end of his or her life guiltless and deserving of heaven. Ever since Eden, there's just been this grim invincibility about sin. No one beats it. It damns all alike. But in phase one of his salvation program, God overcomes it. In the language of verse 3, he atones. That's what this initial salvation era from Eden to Pentecost is all about. Atonement. And of course, he takes it slowly. He builds up to it, establishing first of all this intricate system involving priests and animal sacrifices and that temple, which I said is such a focus in verses 1 to 4, a system which in itself couldn't actually effect atonement, but which paved the way for the real atoning act, the bloody death of Jesus Christ on Calvary's cross. Remember how that event concluded. With that great cry from Jesus' lips, it is finished. What is finished, Jesus? Well, phase one of God's salvation is finished. The phase in which God overcomes the problem of sin, the atoning phase of his salvation. It is now complete. This era in which atonement was the name of the game and everything was oriented towards atonement, a whole building in Jerusalem, a whole day in the annual calendar, a whole tribe in the family of Israel, everything was all about atonement. Well, now it's over because atonement has been secured. It's in the bag. That's what Jesus is saying as he cries, "It is finished. Tis finished." All the debt is paid. Justice divine is satisfied. The grand and full atonement made. God, for a guilty world, has died. What a fantastic phase of salvation phase one is, isn't it? Here's this vile thing called sin. And it always prevails, irresistibly condemning men and women to eternal hell, but God prevails over the prevailer. God prevails over sin. You atone for our transgressions, verse 3 jubilantly asserts. God overcomes that terrible, terrible problem. But then things move on And in phase two, in verses 5-8, the problem which God overcomes is tumult. Tumult. Verse 7, you'll notice, refers to the tumult of the peoples. It's the idea then of the nations in a kind of frenzied state, making lots of commotion. What is this tumult? What is this commotion of the nations? Well, we're probably meant to understand it as a combination of the nations boasting grandly of their own accomplishments on the one hand, and the nations engaging in wild and dissolute worship of their gods on the other hand. That's what all this noise and chaos is. And it's a grim picture then. As phase one ends, there's now this great atonement in place, which God has marvellously secured. But the trouble is, the world at large is in no mood to embrace the atonement. The nations aren't waiting with bated breath for that Good Friday cry, "It is finished." They aren't queuing up, wanting to be first in line to avail themselves of Christ's sin-defeating sacrifice. They're in this sort of drunken state, sounding off about how great they are, directing a cacophony of disorderly homage to an array of different deities. It's a major problem then, this tumult of the peoples. Can anything be done about it? Are the nations of the world just going to permanently rampage, stupidly oblivious to the reality and the beauty of the living and true God? Well, no. Because in phase two of his salvation program, God overcomes the tumult. He quells it. He subdues it. And he replaces the mindless commotion with, verse 8, shouts for joy. That is, shouts of joyful praise to Yahweh. It's a lovely idiom there in verse 8, actually. Literally, the second half of the verse speaks of the going out of the morning and the going out of the evening. It means east and west. The morning, as it were, goes out from the east because there the sun rises. The evening, as it were, goes out from the west because there the sun sets. And so it's the idea in the second half of verse 8 there of people right across the globe, people who once were steeped in self-absorbed, idol-worshipping tumult, now having exchanged that frenzy for the praise of Yahweh. And of course, as we sit here this evening then, phase two is well underway, isn't it? We sang earlier, as o'er each continent and island, the dawn leads on another day, the voice of prayer is never silent, nor dies the strain of praise away. The sun that bids us rest is waking our brethren neath the western sky. And hour by hour, fresh lips are making thy wondrous doings heard on high. From east to west, God is now silencing the tumult of the peoples and filling their mouths with the worship of Yahweh instead. By the way, notice that phase two is presented to us here as the answer to prayer. It's introduced in verse 5 with that line, "By awesome deeds you answer us with righteousness." You see, during phase one, when the nations were still in their tumult, the tiny people of God of that era, oriented still toward the temple in Jerusalem, they were praying for the nations. Look at verse 2, which of course is located within phase 1. O you who hear prayer, to you shall all flesh come. The nations will come to you, Yahweh, because we're praying for it to happen. And it will happen one day. If you want an example of such prayer, just glance at the psalm I read at the beginning of our service, Psalm 67. May God be gracious to us and bless us and make his face to shine upon us, that your way may be known on earth, your saving power among all nations. Let the peoples praise you, O God. Let all the peoples praise you. That kind of praying was going on throughout phase number one. The Davids of this world were praying that the nations might worship Yahweh, might exchange their frenzy, their tumult, for the worship of Yahweh. And the very fact then that you and I are sitting in this building this evening and we're here as Gentiles to worship Yahweh, the God of David, that is itself an answer to David's prayers. And an answer to the prayers of many who sang those psalms 2, 3 millennia ago. That's an amazing thought, isn't it? That we don't often think that we are here tonight as worshippers of Yahweh because people prayed for us. And I don't just mean your parents and your grandparents and whoever. I mean people millennia ago prayed that the nations would come to Yahweh. And now we, the nations, have come to Yahweh. So marvel then at phase 2 of God's salvation. It just seems impossible that the nations of the world would ever, ever thoughtfully and intelligently praise the true God. Their tumult, their frenzy is too set in, too deep-rooted. But God overcomes it. But eventually, phase 2 must end. And in phase 3 then, in verses 9 to 13, the problem which God overcomes is what I'm going to call barrenness. Barrenness. There was a report that came out a couple of years ago, and it hit the headlines with its conclusion that Britain is one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world. I think it was a reference then to the loss of natural woodland and many species that have gone extinct and all the rest of it. Britain, one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world. Now, that may well be so, but the perspective of this psalm is that not just Britain, but the world as a whole is pretty nature-depleted and barren. It contains wilderness, verse 12. Now, wilderness is an environment then that pretty much epitomizes barrenness, isn't it? But actually, the psalm implies that it's not only the wildernesses that are the problem. Even the meadows and the valleys, environments that we would associate perhaps with lushness and with fertility and with fruitfulness, they are in fact somewhat bare. And in need of clothing. That's the imagery that's used there in verse 13, isn't it? When we were on holiday the other week, Fraser was having his breakfast one morning, enjoying a view. And he said at one point, you would almost think one knew that the fall had never happened. And sometimes perhaps we do think like that. We look at some beautiful vista and we think, wow, you'd almost think the fall had never happened. But then you think, hang on a minute, what would Adam say if he was looking at this view right now? Would he say, wow, you'd almost think the fall had never happened? No, he'd probably say, oh dear, what's gone on? This is nothing like what I knew. What's happened to this place? Even the most beautiful places that you and I can think of, he would say, dear me, how nature depleted, how barren, what's happened, what's gone on? Because he knew what it used to be. And it's sad then, it's sad, this nature depletion, this barrenness that the psalmist is talking about there, the existence of wilderness, even the meadows and the valleys, kind of naked, needing to be dressed. It's sad. You don't have to be a member of Greenpeace in order to lament the state that's the creation is in. In fact, we have far more reason as Christians than most members of Greenpeace do to lament it. We should lament creation's barrenness, the disrepair in which the creation is in. But this is the thing, you see. God has already overcome the problem of sin. That was phase one. God is right now overcoming the problem of tumult. It's happening. It's underway. We're evidence of it here tonight. And last of all, in phase 3, at the very end of history, God will overcome the problem of barrenness. And he will revitalize this sad, decrepit creation to such a degree that verse 12 then says the pastures of the wilderness will overflow. Pastures and wilderness just don't go together, do they? It's an oxymoron, and especially overflowing pastures. But the pastures of the wilderness will overflow. Those bare meadows, even the most apparently fruitful meadows that you can think of right now, that you know somewhere, they're actually so bare and naked, and yet they will be clothed, verse 13. The valleys will be decked. At the end of history, phase number 3, God will overcome the problem of barrenness and wonderfully revitalize the creation itself. So those then are the phases of God's salvation program. And my question then to you is this: are you, through faith in Jesus Christ, part of this? Part of this? Does this mean something to you tonight? Does it excite you tonight? Because you know that this is of the utmost relevance to you. Because you're a saved person. Can you say tonight that there in phase 1, with its climax at the cross of Calvary, my sin was atoned for? Can you say tonight that in phase 2 that is now underway, I've become one of those whose natural drunken stupor has been replaced with praise of Yahweh? Can you say tonight that in phase 3, when it comes, I, with my pulse racing, I will witness with my own eyes this barren creation coming to life all around me? Are you part of this great salvation with its 3 phases that Psalm 65 identifies? Phases. We'll move much more quickly as we move secondly to pictures. That's our second word, pictures. The psalmist, of course, is living in phase 1. And it must have been then very difficult for him to imagine phase 2. Remember, we said phase 2 is God overcoming the problem of tumult and stilling the nation's tumult and replacing the nation's tumult with praise. And it must have been then very hard for the psalmist living in phase 1 to visualize that the nations in his day are still very much, almost entirely, in their tumult. And the idea then of that tumult one day being subdued, it must have been so hard to conceptualize. But what the psalmist does is this: he fastens on a little picture within his own world, within the world that he did know. And that picture is there in verse 7. It's God stilling a tumultuous storm, a literal storm, a storm at sea. I don't think that he's referring here to something miraculous, like Jesus stilling the storm on the Sea of Galilee, but just as part of God's ordinary governance of the universe, God stilling a tumultuous storm. I think of an occasion when we were booked on a ferry on a Saturday and the sea was so stormy that the ferry was cancelled, and we were transferred then to a ferry on the Monday, and we crossed that day and it was like a mill pond. And God then had stilled those tumultuous seas. And that's the kind of thing that the psalmist is thinking about in verse 7. And he's using that then to help him comprehend what was otherwise so incomprehensible for him. As he thinks of a sea, of the waves of a sea being stilled by God, that helps him to understand how one day the very nations, the tumult of the nations, their frenzy will be stilled, a and God will start to bring the people of the nations to himself, to be worshippers of the living and true God. So you see then how he kind of fastens on that little picture from his own world to help him. But if phase two must have been hard for the psalmist to understand and to imagine, the same also applies then to phase three, doesn't it? Phase three, we said, is the creation being revitalized, God overcoming the problem of creation's barrenness and bringing this dry and arid creation back to life. That must have been very hard for the psalmist to visualize. But again, what he does is he fastens on a little picture within his own world, the world that he knew, to help him understand and comprehend what God was one day going to do. And the picture then that he fastens on is in verses 9 to 11, and it's the annual harvest, when God, in the language of verse 11 there, crowns the year with his bounty. And as the psalmist then thought about that time of year when just everything was so fruitful, and the fields and the trees and the bushes would come alive, that helped him in a small way to visualize phase three of God's salvation program, when in a much greater way the creation will come alive. Now, you and I don't need the picture of the storm being stilled to help us to understand phase two, because we're in phase two. We can see the nations' tumult being stilled. We're part of it, in fact. We are the tumultuous nations being stilled and being turned into worshippers of Yahweh. So we don't need a picture for that. We're different from the psalmist in that sense. But we do still need a picture that we can latch onto of phase three, because that's still as unrealized for us, phase three, as it was for the psalmist. And so we too can fasten onto this picture that we have in verses 9 to 11. It's particularly appropriate, I guess, for this time of year, isn't it? We're approaching harvest time. And we're aware then, aren't we, of a certain vitality about the creation around us. Only a relative vitality, but a real vitality about the creation around us at this time of year. I walk here on a morning and the bushes are full of blackberries. The hedgerow is full of blackberries. We come back from holiday and you could almost lose yourself in the grass in our garden. It's grown so much with the rain and the sunshine. There are trees with apples and pears weighing down the branches. Creation is kind of coming to life at this time of year. And that then is a tiny, 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 tiny picture for us of the coming to life of creation that's going to happen at the end of history in phase three of salvation. The difference between this time of year and winter, when the ground is hard and the fields are empty and the trees are bare, that is a little picture of the vastly greater difference between creation as it will be then on that day at the great culmination and creation as it is now. At harvest time, it's as if God visits the earth. That's the very suggestive language at the start of verse 9. He's talking about harvest there. At harvest time, it's as if God visits the earth. And it's a faint preview then of when he really will visit the earth and make it overflow with abundance and with life and with fruitfulness and with fertility. And so, as we're at this point in the year, enjoy this time of year for its own sake. Enjoy the bounty and the beauty of this time of year, giving praise to God. But enjoy it too as a picture of something in the future. A little faint preview of a day that's coming when, in a way that we can't really imagine, this creation will burst into life, liberated, as Paul will put it, from its bondage to decay. Phases, pictures, and then thirdly and finally, praises. Praises. There's a marvellous escalation takes place as this psalm progresses. And it's an escalation then of praises. So phase one refers to God being praised in Zion. But it's muted praise. It's actually literally muted praise that is being described there in verse 1. The footnote reading is the better one. Praise waits for you in silence. So there's this silent praise of God going on in phase 1 of his salvation program. And probably then it's just this point that, relatively speaking, it's a very small assembly of worshippers in phase 1. It's just Israel. And of course, it's not even all of Israel, because many of them are apostate at many points. It's a very small assembly of worshippers in phase 1 of salvation, focused there on the temple in Jerusalem. And so it's almost silent, this praise. It's so faint. It's almost inaudible. That's why it says praise waits for you in silence. The nations, you see, aren't yet part of this choir. And so the worship is very, 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 very quiet. But then, in phase 2, the nations come on board. And the praises become audible at last. They are shouts for joy there in verse 8. And we then are part of that. We've come on board. We've joined the choir. We Gentiles. We men and women of the nations. We've come and we've raised the decibel level of the praises of God. It was so quiet in phase 1, but now it's louder because we're part of it. We've joined our voices. And now there are these shouts of joy going on, but there's still something lacking. There's still something lacking because creation is still done. Creation isn't yet on board. Creation hasn't yet joined the choir. Creation hasn't yet joined the anthem. But then you see in phase 3 at the end, that finally changes. And the wilderness, the hills, the meadows, and the valleys join the chorus. So that in that last line of the psalm, it's no longer silent praise like it was in phase 1. It's no longer just joyful shouts as it was in phase 2. It's now shouting and singing together for joy. And you know, this really is the great story of history. What is the great story? What's the great narrative of history? It's not the ever-increasing urbanization of our world. It's not the ever-rising sea temperatures. That's not the great narrative of history. The great story of history is the ever-escalating praises of the living God. That's the direction history is traveling in. That's what it's all about at the end of the day. You won't find that in any newspaper tomorrow. It won't be said, it won't be referred to on the national news. But that's the great story that's going on apace within history. The praises of the living and true God are escalating. They're gathering momentum. They were silent. They were quiet for a whole era. Now the decibel level has risen as the Gentiles, the nations have come on board, and one day creation itself will join the chorus. All other noise is going to be drowned out. All other voices, all other sounds are going to be drowned out. This is the great rising sound, the sound of more and more voices praising God. And my question to you as I close then is, are you part of this? If not, will you join tonight? Will you take your place tonight in the choir? Soon the very trees of the field are going to start singing. Soon the rivers are going to start clapping their hands, the psalmists say. Soon creation is going to join in deafening noise, the choir, the chorus of praise. Will you tonight join the chorus of praise? Will you become a worshipper of God? That's what history is all about. If you've never started, start tonight. Join the chorus in praise of Almighty God. Amen.